Hello, listeners. This is Cody Starkin welcoming you to another episode of Standing Post. This month, we continue our journey learning about the Secret Service by talking to Special Agent Mark Grants, who runs one of the many electronic crimes task forces in the United States, and who also works in our Washington field office. In 1995, the Secret Service created the New York Electronic Crimes Task Force. As a result of its success, Congress mandated the establishment of the National Network to prevent, detect, and investigate electronic crimes, including potential terrorist attacks against critical infrastructures and financial payment systems. Today, the Secret Service's 40 ECTFs leverage the combined resources of academia, the private sector, and local, state, and federal law enforcement. ECTFs are a strategic alliance of law enforcement, academia, and the corporate sector dedicated to investigating, disrupting, and deterring homeland security-related cybercrime, as well as cyber-related high-consequence events related to Secret Service missions and critical infrastructure sectors. The ECTFs seek to prioritize investigative cases that involve electronic crime and concentrate their resources in the following three areas: cyber protection, cyber investigation, and cyber tools. Please welcome to the show Special Agent Mark Grants. Mark, it's really great to have you on the podcast. Will you please introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, it's Mark Grants. I'm 19 years with the Secret Service. Started out in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I was there for about 6-7 years. Did some computer forensics. I was fortunate early on to get involved in computers there. From there, that opportunity kind of opened itself up, transferred to the cyber intelligence section here in Washington, D.C. at our headquarters. Following that, I did technical security for 5 years. And then was promoted out of technical security to the Washington field office, where currently I am the supervisor over the Electronic Crimes Task Force.
What did you do prior to, so you said you were in computer forensics, but as far as that, who you were doing that for?
Yeah, so I guess going way back, I graduated from Penn State with an administration of justice degree. Following that, I was a police officer for about 7 years prior to the Secret Service. And at the time, I was always involved in computers. I didn't really take any formal education, but was always playing with stuff. I remember setting up websites for the police department where I was at, kind of dabbling in some other web design stuff. And again, as I said, 7 years as a police officer, I was in a small department. I knew there wasn't a whole lot of opportunity to really grow. So in the late 90s, I started looking into federal law enforcement, and the Secret Service at the time was hiring. So I was able to jump over and get hired in January 2000.
And with the previous individuals that have come through and talked on the podcast, they've all had different experiences on how they heard about the Secret Service and how they joined up. What was your story?
I had some exposure to it early on in college. We did career fairs, and I was actually involved with the student organization that helped run the career fairs. So, you know, I got to meet a lot of folks. Not that I remember too many of them, but I, you know, I was able to meet a lot of folks from the FBI, from the U.S. Marshals Service, from DEA, ATF, and of course the Secret Service. So, even when I got hired as a police officer, I always kind of had in the back of my mind that, you know, at some point in time, I wanted to kind of broaden my horizons and go for something a little higher.
Now, did you become an agent or were you part of the uniform division?
No, I went direct to the special agent program.
Okay. And how long did it take for you to realize, or did you always have in the back of your mind that you wanted to do computer forensics or work in the cybercrime field?
Yeah, I had always had an interest, as I mentioned, again, at a small police department, there really wasn't much cybercrime to investigate. But again, I was always messing around with computers, even going back, you know, as a kid, back in the VIC 20 days for the people that were on back then. So when I went to, when I started in Pittsburgh, they had a forensic examiner, and he ended up taking a position elsewhere and moved on. And so that created an opening fairly early on in my career. So, you know, I jumped at the chance to get that training, start down that path.
And did you have an opportunity to start out in the computer forensics within the Secret Service?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, that was my first exposure to real forensic program.
So you had mentioned that you had ended up, or you're currently right now with the Washington field office. I also want to make note too, they're our first interview from a field office. And I don't know, I'm happy to have you here to be able to give that perspective on the field office and their capabilities and what they do. And I really wanted to get into some of the stories that you have with the field office and some of the partnerships that you have through the field office. But you've become the assistant to the special agent in charge of the
Electronic Crime Task Force for the Washington Field Office. Can you talk a little bit about how you arrived at that position?
And so, again, having kind of a background doing the forensics, spending a couple of years here at headquarters, that's kind of been my niche throughout my career is electronic crimes. So when I finished up, when I was getting close to the end of my time in technical security, found out that I was being considered for promotion and came over to the Washington Field Office. At the time I came over, there were some other individuals that were already running the Electronic Crimes Task Force that were senior to me. And so so I did a couple other roles. I was a supervisor over the Operations Center desk, which is basically a 24-hour response that the Washington Field Office has. And then following that, I did about a little over a year in the Protection Squad, supervising that. But I always had one eye on the Electronic Crimes Task Force and had the hope that at some point in time when that position opened up, I would be able to slide down. So when Chris Gagne was promoted out of Washington Field Office over to CID, I was fortunate again to be able to slide into that position. That would have been about a year and a half or 2.5 years ago.
Some of the listeners and some of our law enforcement partners may understand the field office concept, but for those individuals that may not, can you kind of give an overview of what a field office does for the Secret Service?
Yeah, so the field offices in the Secret Service, there's approximately 150 or so. About 20 of those are international, the rest obviously domestic. Field offices are responsible primarily for investigating crimes that happen in their jurisdiction, in their area. Most of the crimes are going to be fraud, counterfeit, electronic crimes. Obviously, our background is financial in nature. So we're responsible for investigating those type of crimes that either the victim or the suspect lives in that jurisdiction, lives in that district. Beyond the investigations, we also do protective intelligence work. So again, if when I was in Pittsburgh, if someone made a threat to the president, that field office is responsible to go out and identify that person, interview that person, and determine what level that threat actually is. And then, of course, the big one is anytime there's a visit, anytime there's a presidential visit, any type of Secret Service protectee coming to that district, that field office is essentially the liaison with local law enforcement, with local fire department, with whatever venue you happen to be visiting. That the field office kind of takes the lead in making those connections and kind of making way for the presidential detail or whoever it is coming to town.
And the Washington Field Office is kind of unique, too, because you almost share an area with the headquarters, but you have your own individual responsibilities. What makes you unique compared to other field offices?
Yes, we are. I mean, we're just about literally in the shadow of headquarters, but just like any other field office, we've got our own areas of responsibility, investigations, protective intelligence. The thing that makes the Washington Field Office unique is if you look at some of our offices, they may only get a handful of protective visits a year, sometimes less than that. Some offices, bigger offices in New York City is probably the best example, probably gets hundreds of visits a year. We get hundreds of visits a year, plus the president lives in our backyard, the vice president lives in our backyard, cabinet, other Secret Service protectees. So just opening the doors day in and day out takes a certain amount of manpower the Washington Field Office is responsible for. So it makes it that much more challenging. The Secret Service, one of the things that makes us different from many other agencies is that dual mission. We have the investigative purpose, but we also have the no-fail mission of protecting the president. And probably nowhere else in the Secret Service besides Washington Field Office do you really see that day in and day out.
And I would really like to discuss kind of the mission and the functions of what the ECTF has and what it has to offer. And I want to go, if it's okay, just to kind of go into some stories that you may have regarding what your task force has gone through and some of the stories you could provide to the listeners. Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe start with when you became the ATSAC for the ECTF and maybe go from there.
Yeah, so the Electronic Crimes Task Force, you know, our squad, we've got about a dozen agents, and then we've got anywhere from 6, 8, 10 of other partners from other agencies that are involved with the task force as well. Generally, the agents in the squad all have 2 or 3 investigations at any one time that they're working. And those kind of cases are ransomware, business email compromise, network intrusions, anything cyber. In addition to the work that we do, we support the other criminal squads within the Washington Field Office. So any criminal investigation to some degree has some type of cyber component. If you're doing fraud, if you're doing counterfeit, anything just about, at a minimum, you're going to have a cell phone. And 99% of the people have a laptop, And that laptop a lot of times has information that that may pertain to the investigation. So we do a lot of support for the other squads in the office as well.
So my first experience with an ECTF, I spent a week down at the Miami field office, and I got to see some of the cool things that they had there. Yep. And some of the forensic equipment they had. And when you brought up the fact that everybody has, well, most people have a cell phone, a lot of people have laptops, but there's certain situations in your investigative work that you have to access that information and that you have a team that's able to go in and pull that data out, and you're literally dissecting cell phones, you're dissecting laptops. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so in my office, we've got 5 forensic examiners, and they can do anything from your regular PCs to Macs to cell phones to Linux. You know, there's a lot of flavors out there that we have the capability to look into. And kind of the approach that we take is, you kind of mentioned dissect, but we also look at it as an interrogation of that digital device. So if you have a laptop, you have a phone, you're looking for keys to that investigation. And even if you don't find those keys, why didn't you find those keys? It's not, you know, the way some agencies work, they have a computer scientist that does the exams. The investigator tells them, look for this. If they find it, great. If they don't, then that's kind of the end of the story. But the Secret Service methodology is our forensic examiners are also investigators themselves. And so, again, they're looking at it almost as an interrogation, looking for how, why, when, where, you know, all the facts behind the case. You know, the guys are diligent. They work hard at their craft. We've got a lot of partners outside of our little group of 5 that you can always reach out to for assistance. But the work that they do, again, touches everything nowadays. So it's kind of a nonstop shop.
And I'm curious about that. You say treat it as an investigation of the device. Is that just an ethos or a culture that you kind of adopt so that you kind of set in this mindset?
Yeah. Again, if you're looking for a counterfeit bill and it's not on there and every indication from the investigation says it should be, then again, the answer shouldn't be just, hey, we didn't find it, case closed, and move on. You start looking at why isn't it there? You start looking at, well, we're not seeing it, but we are seeing this software over here that is used to wipe evidence, that is used to delete things securely. And so those type of things that maybe some examiners aren't necessarily looking for, we think that our examiners have those skills and those experience to find those clues.
So one of the stories that came out of the ECTF at the Washington field office was MageCart. Before we have these interviews, I always talk to the individuals before the show, and that's one of the topics you brought up that really fascinated me, if you could go into it a little bit.
Historically speaking, from my experience 10 years ago when I was working here in headquarters, the hackers, the criminals were mainly going after large databases. At the time, a lot of the retailers would store their credit card data, oftentimes store it unencrypted, and that was the target to go after a big retail company and try to steal 1 million credit cards, 5 million credit cards, get that all at once. Over the years, the industry, the retail industry, has done a much better job at securing that data. Just like any other industry, the bad guys then pivot to go after what they can and try to continue to be productive from their point of view. So what we've seen over the last couple of years is an attack against the e-commerce side of the web retail companies. So instead of going after that massive database, we're going to strictly attack the e-commerce platform or the checkout page. Okay, so when you go in and you type in your information, you type in your name, your address, your credit card number, expiration date, all that good stuff. When you hit the submit button, one copy of that is going to the retail company, but an extra copy of that is going to the hacker and to a server that they control elsewhere. So they're getting that real-time information, which is very valuable to them because, again, when you look at the old time when they were getting databases, a lot of that credit card data was old. And so you kind of had to parse through that 1 million credit cards to, all right, how many of these are expired? How many of these have already been flagged for other fraud? Whereas if I can get your credit card hot off the press, you just bought something with it an hour ago. Now that credit card's in circulation with the criminal underground within days or weeks at the most.
We had Matt O'Neill on the podcast a couple episodes ago, and we discussed about that where they just will get the bulk of the information, and if one doesn't work, they move on to the next one. If one doesn't work, they move on to the next one. So I'm assuming this is the same case.
Yeah. It's, you know, for better or worse, there's so many businesses out there. One of the e-commerce platforms that we're looking at right now that has some vulnerabilities, they've got over 500,000 customers worldwide. Researchers have looked at it, and they've identified 200,000 that have vulnerabilities. And then another researcher has looked at it, and he's identified 40,000 businesses, online businesses, that have some indication that there might be a compromise. So again, it's a shotgun approach, and they don't spend a whole lot of time if they know they're not going to be successful because there's so many other opportunities out there.
Mark, you talked about the cyber fraud or how cyber hackers can go in and to Magecart or some other programs out there and be able to steal the information, but that's not all that you do. I think there was an incident that occurred last year during the inauguration where you had found hackers got into the DC traffic cameras. Can you give us a little bit of a background on that?
This was actually, I'd say a week, maybe 8 days prior to the inauguration in 2017. And we received a phone call from our critical systems protection group who had been working with the city looking at their infrastructure. And they had discovered that a number of their camera systems around the city had been compromised with ransomware. So ransomware, for those that aren't familiar, essentially the bad guys gain access. They encrypt all of your data. They encrypt your system. And then to get access back, you've got to send them money. You got to send them a payment, usually through Bitcoin. And that was the situation in this case. So at the time, obviously, a week before inauguration, we're at a heightened sense of alert. Everything's kind of locked in at that moment. This is our Super Bowl to a large degree. You know, there's a tremendous amount of assets and effort put into the security plan. So for something like this to happen a week ahead of time, on the heels of the foreign influence in the campaign, you had a lot of stories about Antifa and anarchists causing problems at the inauguration. So it was a great concern to us that if you take away our eyes, then that significantly impacts our ability to secure an event of this magnitude. So we were able to get our agents on the ground the night that we got the call. I think we got the call at about 4 o'clock. One of my agents responded to the city, to their operations center. He was there probably till 9, 10 o'clock that night, working the case, looking at information, looking at some of the systems that had been compromised. Really, it was probably one of the best examples, I think, of an incident response from the Secret Service. We had about a 4-agent team. We had 3 of my agents and then 1 agent from Cyber Intel that responded, and for the next week pretty much did nothing but the incident response to this breach. Ultimately, we ended up doing a search warrant on a residence in London through the assistance of the National Crime Agency and the UK's Met Police. As well as support from the DC U.S. Attorney's Office. And I know when I talk to other investigators, especially folks that work in the federal world, to be able to get a case from incident to search warrant in a foreign country in 7 days is basically unheard of. So it really speaks volumes to the work that my folks did, that the U.S. Attorney's Office did, and also our partners overseas. Ultimately, the door that we kicked in the U.K. in London turned out to be a victim of the fraudsters. But ultimately, we were able to identify 2 Romanian citizens. Turns out it was more a crime of opportunity, more of just kind of your standard fraud. They were able to get access. We don't believe they necessarily knew what they were getting into. We just know that they got into a system and they tried to lock it down for ransom. So the case right now, one of the individuals, a female Romanian individual, has been extradited to the U.S. and she's already pled guilty and awaiting sentencing. And the other part of the equation, a male, another Romanian, is under house arrest in Bucharest right now. We hope to get him extradited.
Mark, in regards to the DC camera case, can you give the listeners a timeline from discovery to arrest and kind of give them an idea about how long these cases can take regarding cybercrime?
Specific to the DC camera case, this was actually one of the quicker ones. You know, oftentimes you're looking at a nickname or an email address, and that's really all you have to start with, maybe just an IP address. And oftentimes, again, it takes years, you know, 1, 2, 3 years just to be able to identify someone and be able to put together enough evidence to say that, yes, this guy on the other side of the world is the guy that broke into this computer system. Specific again to the camera case, I think because of the emphasis, because of the tie-in to our protection front, we put a lot of work into it. Again, the agents that worked on this case from the beginning and on through arrest put in a tremendous amount of time. We were fortunate that the bad guys made a couple mistakes in using U.S.-based email services. So that was one of our big early breaks. So we were able to subpoena and do search warrants on these email accounts, which led to more email accounts, which kind of spun off and eventually allowed us to identify the suspects. That one happened relatively quick. Once we had identified the individuals, Now, all of a sudden, though, you're at the mercy of your international partners. You know, in this situation, we had identified the suspects as being in Romania, and we were fortunate in that one of the agents in my squad was on a temporary assignment to Europol. And so it was a huge advantage to be able to call him up and say, hey, Dave, you know, we really need this information. We're looking for this. We're looking for that. And instead of it going into kind of the massive black hole of bureaucracy that a lot of times these turn into, he would walk down the hall and knock on the door of the Romanian investigator that's stationed at Europol and say, hey, we need this, we need that, we need this. And then sometimes within an hour or two, we had an answer back. So, you know, again, having that relationship, having boots on the ground in various cities. We also obviously have an office in Bucharest, so we relied on them as well. But, you know, all told, I think, again, notification in January, and it was right around the holidays that we were putting the other search warrants. Unfortunately, it was one of those hurry up and wait deals where we kind of knew what we wanted to do and who we wanted, but we're told to kind of slow down due to some investigative work that the Romanians were doing. And then all of a sudden the Romanians said, hey, we're going to be arresting these guys in 2 weeks. They're related to your guys. You might want to get your paperwork done. And so, you know, one of my agents, James, spent pretty much his whole Thanksgiving break writing arrest warrants and preparing the paperwork, the non-glamorous side of investigations. Everybody likes the beginning part where you're looking for bad guys, but nobody likes writing 20-page reports and 20-page statements of probable cause. So the guys in my squad put in a tremendous amount of time. Again, weekends, holidays, you know, they really put in the extra effort to make sure that we could catch up to where the Romanians were at.
And do you find that often within your organization where you just have these individuals, I would maybe even novices, just trying something out, but you catch it catches your attention, and then it finally ends up with these situations like this? Like you had mentioned that they didn't know, or they may have not understood what they did. Does that happen often in your line of work?
It's somewhat of that shotgun approach, whereas the cyber criminals today, a lot of them have automated tools where they're crawling the network, crawling the internet, and they're looking for vulnerable systems. And when they find a vulnerable system, they attack it with tools that they know that'll work. You know, there's still specific targets that individuals may go, hey, I really want to break into this computer system. I really want to break into this company because I know they have something of value. But for the run-of-the-mill hackers, again, they scan the internet, they look for vulnerable systems, and they attack where they can. If, you know, if they find a system that they think's vulnerable, they start banging away at it, but they can't get in. They're businessmen. They look out at return on investment, and if they can find an easier target elsewhere, they're going to move on quickly.
So like I mentioned before, we had Matt O'Neill on the show, and he talked about email compromises to private citizens. But you also, from the ECTF, you look at it from the business side of the house, so a business email compromise. You had mentioned that before, and I was hoping that maybe you can talk, too, about those examples.
Yeah, so business email compromise, it's been around for a number of years, but it continues to be successful and continues to lead to, I think the 2017 numbers are in the billions in losses. It's not quite as sexy as some of the new cutting edge stuff that you hear about, but the reality is it has a huge impact and on businesses big and small. Essentially what's happening is, and this goes back to phishing, everybody should be familiar with phishing and hopefully have some awareness of that when you get that email that doesn't quite look right, that, you know, isn't coming from the address you thought it should, don't click on that link, don't open that attachment up. Essentially what's happening is businesses are getting phished. They're giving away their credentials, or they're allowing access to their system. Bad guys on the other end are then infiltrating their email system, reading the emails back and forth, learning the business, and then inserting themselves in the conversation at a near future date. And what they'll do is, as I'm, say, doing business with Cody Incorporated, I'll send you an email and say, hey, Cody, I know you owe me $100,000 for our latest business arrangement. We've got a new banking system. I'd like you to change the payment format to this. And they give you a new account number. And if you're not paying close attention, assume that it's your trusted business partner. But in reality, it's a domain or an email address that's been created specifically to look like your trusted partner. And so you look at it, you glance at it, you think it's all good, and you send $100,000 to that new account. The new account obviously is controlled by the bad guys, and before you know it, your money's gone.
So you see these crimes and you investigate them and you see them hopefully to term. But also, too, there's another aspect where you're bringing awareness and you're bringing the attention to businesses before it does happen. And you do that in a forum, a quarterly meeting that you have with partnerships within the D.C. area, possibly into the Maryland and Virginia area. Mm-hmm. And so you hold these sessions to educate and inform those different businesses and law enforcement officials. Can you talk a little bit about that, too?
Yeah, so I think going way back about 20 years ago, the Electronic Crimes Task Force model started in New York City with our New York field office. And those were kind of the pioneers, Bob Weaver and the guys back in those days came up with the philosophy and really pushed that law enforcement needs to be more inclusive. We need to include private industry. We need to include academia and obviously include our other law enforcement partners. So that's kind of been a mantra of the Secret Service and the Electronic Crimes Task Force, again, for 20 years. So specifically here in Washington, D.C., as you mentioned, we do meetings every 3, 4, 5 months, kind of varies. We try to tailor it to our audience. Some successful ones that we've had recently, 2 years ago, we did a meeting on specifically on ransomware, and that was a joint operation that we did with the FBI. So our agency, their agency put together a package presentation that we gave to all of our local businesses and local partners. Last year was a business email compromise. Once again, as we just talked about, business email compromise and the impact that it has, you know, we sat down and had a long meeting and gave the folks a lot of good information, we believe, in hopes of trying to prevent those crimes. Obviously, our job is to catch bad guys, but we would be more than happy if we can prevent a lot of the crime from happening in the first place. So those meetings are an opportunity for us to get the message out, to educate our partners what the current trends are, what they need to do. We don't offer silver bullets, unfortunately, that makes everything go away, but we try to better prepare them for what they face.
And do you have any success stories that come out of those quarterly meetings, things that you've been able to provide, or at least that information exchange to help?
I don't know. Again, unfortunately, the business community doesn't always reach back out to us and tell us. You know, one of the things, talking business email compromise, we tell the businesses that if there's any change in billing, there should be a two-factor authentication. There should be a phone call that makes that verification. I don't know how many folks have actually, been victimized and stopped that fraud from happening by making a phone call first. But again, that's something that we try to put out there, examples like that.
But also too, on the same line with the partnerships, you also, in a way, have a grassroots effort that you actually have a partnership with the University of Maryland to help coach and mentor students that may be interested in forensics, cybercrime, cybersecurity. And that was something that you had brought up in our initial meeting when we talked before the podcast. And I think it's a great opportunity maybe to discuss that a little bit too.
This kind of goes back to my predecessor, Chris Gagne. When I took over for Chris, Chris had a good relationship with Michelle Cukier at the University of Maryland, what they call the ACES program, which is Advanced Computer Experience for Students. And it's basically their cybersecurity students up there. And Chris encouraged me to go out and meet Mr. Cukier and try to continue that relationship. So at our first meeting, one of the things that we talked about was a mentoring program that the University of Maryland had already established with a couple of other government agencies and large government contract businesses. So, you know, we kind of jumped at the opportunity. I was able to solicit a handful of folks, both from my squad and from headquarters, that stepped in as mentors. Essentially, each semester, we get paired up with a student or students who are interested in the Secret Service. We have two dinners a year up at the University of Maryland where all the mentors, all the students get together. And then outside of that, we try to meet once every other week, once a month or so. This semester, we did two open houses at the Washington field office where we brought the students in, showed them the office, gave them a bit of a brief about what we do in the world of cyber, showed them the forensic lab, and then kind of sat down and answered any questions that they have. We also brought the students out to a business in Annapolis that does cybersecurity that the Baltimore field office had a good relationship with. So we kind of gave them a little glimpse of that. And essentially, we're trying to prepare these students for the future. And it can be something like these tours that we mentioned or something as simple as coaching them through an interview or helping them with their resume.
Mark, one of the unique programs that we have in the Secret Service is that we have the National Cyber Forensic Institute that's in Hoover, Alabama. And I know you play a part in that. You have a nomination process that you're able to nominate local law enforcement individuals to be able to attend the course. Can you provide an overview of that program?
The NCFI, the National Cyber Forensic Institute, is by far one of the best deals going for state and local law enforcement. Essentially, through the Secret Service and DHS, we offer the complete package to train an individual. We offer the airfare, we offer the housing, we offer per diem, we We offer the training, the equipment, the licenses, everything that you would need to train your investigators. And again, this is specifically for state and local law enforcement, as well as prosecutors and judges. The portion that kind of ties into the local field offices is each of the field offices have the ability to nominate individuals for this training. So usually about once every 3 or 4 months, NCFI will open things up. They'll list their classes, and they have a variety of different programs, different training opportunities down there. We share that with our law enforcement partners in the National Capital Region here. And then once we get all the solicitations back, we kind of look it over and determine where we need help. You know, right now we've got one agency that their forensic examiner retired. So they're obviously, you know, that agency is going to be kind of pushed to the top of the list because we want to make sure that that person gets backfilled and gets the latest training and is able to perform that function. But overall, it's fantastic because, again, now you have a much broader scope of experts that they need help from us. They're obviously more than welcome to call us. And at the same token, if I'm overwhelmed with a case, I can reach out to the local partners and ask for their assistance as well.
And you mentioned prosecutors and judges. Like, can you explain why they go? Is it specifically to put hands-on equipment, or are they just trying to understand the...
No, they're given more of an executive level, a higher level. I've seen it from my time going all the way back to Pittsburgh, and recently I actually testified in front of a grand jury. There's folks out there that just aren't very computer savvy, especially if it's a judge or if it's a prosecutor. It can be problematic when you're trying to explain a technical ability to them, and essentially you're just hoping that they believe you because they don't have that understanding. So the opportunity, especially for judges, is they get to go down in an area where they're instructed, where they're trained. They can learn from experts, and they get a better understanding of what is able to happen and what is just kind of pure fiction as well.
So, Mark, when we were doing the pre-interview in your office, I noticed a gold record on your wall from the Recording Industry Association of America. There's an interesting story behind that during your time at the Pittsburgh office. Do you mind providing the story behind that?
So this goes back to, again, as you said, Pittsburgh. As a young agent, we had a good relationship, a great relationship, really, with the local FBI office. So we worked a lot of joint cases together, and they came to us at one point. They were targeting a record store in the north side of Pittsburgh that was selling counterfeit CDs. At the time, that was, the bulk of music that was being sold was on CDs. And the problem with CDs is with the computer and the right software, it's very easy to duplicate them. So apparently this gentleman, the owner of the record store, decided to increase his profits by selling bootleg and counterfeit CDs. So we stepped in, we worked with the FBI on the case. We began doing actually some undercover operations as well. We walked in, nowhere near as exciting as Rafael Barris's undercover operations, but we were able to go into the store. They weren't hiding them. They were pretty much out in the open. Walk in, buy the counterfeit CDs, walk out with them, show them the Recording Industry Association, and they would confirm that, yes, they were counterfeit. And we kind of built our case from there. Probably my biggest contribution to the case was the owner of the record store lived about 5 or 10 miles away from me. So one of the best all-time tools that every investigator, especially in the United States, I'm not sure about foreign investigators, but in the United States, one of the best tools we have is the trash pull. When you take your trash down to the curb at night and you set it out, essentially that's abandoned property. And at that point in time, as an investigator, as a special agent, I don't need a search warrant. I don't need any justification. I can come by and pick your trash up. So every Friday, actually every Thursday for a number of months, I would leave my G-Ride at work. I would take the old Suburban home. And then Friday morning, about 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, I would get up, drive to our suspect's house, roll up with the lights out, quietly jump out of the truck, grab his trash, throw it in the back, and then head into the office. So get to the office, then it's rubber glove time. And then I'd spend the next couple hours digging through trash and pulling out a ton of evidence. It was productive. I'll say that. It certainly wasn't a waste of time, but that was pretty much my Friday routine, like I said, for a number of months. Ultimately, we put together a great case. He did only get 3 years probation. I would have liked to see a little more for the effort, but the owner of the record store got 3 years probation. And after sentencing, the Recording Industry Association came out to Pittsburgh, did a little press release and a little photo shoot, and awarded myself and the FBI case agent with the gold record. So a lot of guys in their career, especially if you've been around long enough, you kind of collect little knickknacks and commendations and awards along the way. You saw my office. I don't have a whole lot up, but the one that I do hang up wherever I go pretty much is that gold record, because I can't imagine there's there's too many of those, Ron.
No, I don't think there is. And that's why we had to ask it. And so thank you.
Yep.
Mark, it's been wonderful to have you on the show specifically to talk about these partnerships, the ECTF and the Washington Field Office. Do you have anything for the listeners before we close out for the episode?
No, I think the one thing that I recommend, and recently I've been doing a lot of presentations to small and medium businesses. One thing that I would highly recommend is cybercrime right now is at a phase where, and again, you hear it all the time, and it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So whenever I talk to folks, I recommend that they have a contact in law enforcement, ideally Secret Service, but as long as they have some type of contact, it doesn't take any huge amount of money. It doesn't even take a lot of time, but you should have some type of a response plan. Doesn't matter, you know, unless you're selling lemonade on the street corner, if you've got a business, you're connected to the internet. And if you're connected to the internet, then there's the chance that you're going to get compromised in some way or another. And ideally, you want to have a plan. The thing that I talk about a lot at these meetings, you know, when the Secret Service, when we're doing protection, that's what we're known for. If the president's speaking at a town hall and somebody jumps out of the crowd and goes crazy, we don't sit back and have a board meeting and decide, all right, well, what do we do next? We don't have a conference call and bring in the attorneys and go, all right, what can we do? We've got a plan. We know what we're all going to do. We know what each individual in that room's responsibilities are, and we act. And so that's what I really push for the private industry, and not just private industry, but other law enforcement, government agencies, academia. Again, if you're connected to the internet, there's a chance that you're going to get hit in one fashion or another. So by all means, have a plan. That plan should include liaisoning with law enforcement. And again, I highly recommend that that conversation with law enforcement be at a quarterly meeting or over a cup of coffee, as opposed to me calling you up and saying, hey, we just bought your crown jewels from a guy named Vladimir.
Well, thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
Yep.
Thank you for listening and continuing your journey with me as I learn more about the U.S. Secret Service through Standing Post. For more information about today's topic, please go to www.secretservice.gov/investigation and click on the ECTF and FCTF link. Until next month, listeners, stay vigilant.